Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The drama over American news and newspapers is not over. Information is everywhere, but news gathering and editing, the bread and butter of newspaper work, are still under the gun of digital challengers and alternatives. A new documentary goes inside the New York Times to look at the struggle from the newsroom angle. This hour on Point, page one, and the future of American news and newspapers. You can join the conversation. Who, what do you count on for news these days? And what if the papers go away? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from media mavens Jeff Jarvis and Alan Mutter, and from David Carr, media columnist for The New York Times. He's featured in the Page One documentary. Just to give a little feel of what was going on when the cameras went to work on the Times and newspapers as the background for this documentary, here's a montage from Page One, TV news clips from 09 and 10 on newspapers in trouble from the new documentary, Page One, inside The New York Times.
Tribune Company, owner of the L.A. Times and the Chicago Tribune, filed for bankruptcy
protection. And the Gannett Company is faltering.
All the news that was fit to print for 88 years.
After 146 years, the print edition is now a thing of the past.
The obituary column these days is full of the death notices of American daily newspapers.
And into that storm went the documentary makers, cameras, and microphones. Joining me in the studio is Andrew Rossi. He's director, co-writer, co-producer of the new documentary, Page One, inside the New York Times. It's currently playing in New York, opening in select theaters nationwide this summer. Andrew Rossi, it's great to have you with us. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Are you a newspaper lover? Why did you turn your camera on newspapers and the Times?
Well, I started making the film in November of 2009 at a moment when the crisis in the newspaper industry had really reached its zenith. Indeed, layoffs were coming to the newsroom of the New York Times, and it seemed a ripe moment to try and look at what the journalism is that goes on in the four walls of a place that has original reporting as its mandate. And indeed, to give viewers a front row seat to what the resources are required to execute on that journalism, and see it all while people like David Carr, a former crack addict who is now the Media Equation columnist at the New York Times,
following the very media that's sort of changing and morphing around the Times and everybody else.
As they report on these stories about the implosion of media. And they themselves are at an institution which is suffering from the same problems.
You were right there in New York at the Times, nearly brand new, sparkling building on Times Square, 41st Street there. And where did you camp out in the Times to sort of your base of operations?
So I was looking at the media desk, and that's a specific department of the New York Times on the third floor. So we're really seeing the Times through that keyhole. Of course, when the media desk writers go out into the world, we follow them when they are in consultation with the foreign desk in regards to WikiLeaks, or indeed the technology desk with regard to the launch of tablets and other devices that are featured in the film. We go
tablets
with
tablets like iPad and what that means all over the place.
That's right.
You're up and down the Times here. So the media desk, the guys reporting on the very kind of storm that is hitting them along with everybody else are at the heart of your film. David Carr maybe foremost at the heart of it, media reporter there. You follow them, you know, all over the building, into the news meetings. We'll hear some of that. And you follow them out of the meeting where they were up against some very tough criticism. David Carr's reporting in your film on what's happening with the media. He's also out in the world defending it. Here he is. You filmed this. This is from a 2009 conference called Intelligence Squared. And media columnist David Carr goes nose to nose defending the mainstream media and the New York Times against Michael Wolff and the, democratization or Twitterization of the news. Let's listen to this back and forth.
The New York Times has dozens of bureaus all over the world, and we're going to toss that out and kick back and see what Facebook turns up. I don't think so.
What you're going to hear tonight is that the media is necessary for the commonweal. An informed citizenry is what this nation is about. That is self-serving crap.
David Carr of the New York Times and media critic Michael Wolff there going nose to nose in the new documentary Page One. Andrew Rossi is director. Now, by my lights, you kind of fell in love with the Times view of things here. You don't seem to be buying the notion that the digital realm is going to produce the news we need as a democracy, unless I read the way you filmed this wrong, Andrew.
Well, Tom, one correction. That footage I did not shoot. That's actually archival from Intelligence Squared debates. So your question about what is the future of news or digitization, I think that the movie is not trying to present any taught answers. It's really trying to explore all the contours of the debate that surround how original reporting can survive. You know, we live in an era when we get links via Twitter and Facebook to all kinds of information, and very often we're not actually realizing that we are linking back to a story in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, Reuters, AP. And so this movie, Page One, is trying to give a human face to this very intellectual debate that we hear about through David and Brian Stelter, who is a reporter that was hired right out of college for the New York Times to report on media. He's actually originally a blogger. And he's a ferocious presence on Twitter, as is David. And it's, I think, you know, it's also an entertainment. So that's a really core point here of the film. It's persuasive via experience, via observation of what takes place in the newsroom. It's aspiring to the cinema verite tradition to really just be present and allow all of these characters, including Bruce Hedlum, who's a media desk editor, to really demonstrate by their behavior and by the teamwork it takes to you know, execute on these stories what journalism is like at a place like the New York Times.
You're there at a moment when even the Times' own future was in question. There were headlines in The Atlantic then saying, you know, the Times itself may go away.
That's right. January, February 2009, The Atlantic runs an article by Michael Hirshhorn entitled End Times. It's a scathing article about all of the financial troubles the New York Times has been in that have befallen them, and in fact speculating that the Times in that particular moment of such crisis could go out of business by May of 2009. So there's a very dynamic interchange between Hirshhorn and Alex Jones, the author of The Trust. And some one of the foremost experts on the Times, discussing the implications of that story.
And Jones says that's just plain stupid.
Exactly.
That's dumb. But others look on and say, you know what? Of course, it sounds unthinkable. But what's unthinkable when everything's changing? And that tension in your film, Page One, comes right in to the Times. You've got your young media reporter up out of the blogosphere, Brian Stelter, frustrated within the New York Times at that time that his colleagues were not using Twitter the way he thinks they ought to, that they weren't as plugged in as they ought to be. Here from the documentary is a back and forth between the young blog guy, Brian Stelter, and David Carr.
I don't know why anybody who's a reporter isn't on Twitter. I constantly berate my colleagues who aren't on it. It drives me nuts when I'll hear about it. You know, I'll hear my colleagues talking about a story at noon, and I read it on Twitter at midnight.
I still can't get over the feeling that Brian Stelter was a robot assembled in the basement of New York Times to come and destroy me.
David Carr, I'm the young blogger, now his colleague at the New York Times. But that whole world was at the gate. In the documentary, the executive editor, Bill Keller, talks about, you know, looking at that and what is necessary, what's required to preserve democracy.
I'm not sure that I can boil it all down to a sort of aha, but I do think there is a growing sense of how much it would matter if the Times weren't here. News organizations that deploy resources to really gather information are essential to a functioning democracy. It just doesn't work if people don't know.
Bill Keller, the New York Times, in the new documentary, Page One. Another big voice in that documentary, Jeff Jarvis, joins us right now from New York, associate professor, director of the interactive program at the City University of New York School of Journalism, author of What Would Google Do? Jeff Jarvis, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Tom.
So there's the assertion, you know, there's the infosphere full of all kinds of information, but you hear Keller saying it takes news organizations that deploy resources. Where do you come down on this, Jeff? Does it take that, or can it be the collective kind of contributions of the democratic web that produce the news we need?
No, it certainly takes news organizations, but news organizations now need to reconsider their role in a larger ecosystem. People are sharing information on their own. The internet enables that. A news organization and a journalist need to ask very specifically how they add value to that. And they can do it in many ways. They can do it certainly first and foremost by reporting, by sometimes summarizing and bringing perspective and bringing context, but also by acting as a platform for that community. We at CUNY are working with the New York Times in Brooklyn on blogs that the community helps report. And part of our role now is to teach them how to do that. So there are many new roles for journalists in a new world.
In page one, the documentary, you're there, so are many other voices in this big sort of debate and ongoing confrontation with the digital present, future. Did you see a love letter to newspapers? Is the kind of, I see support there for what papers did. Does a documentary like this sort of build a constituency, or is what's going on bigger than anything?
I think there's an unintended consequence to the documentary, which, by the way, I think is very good. I think Andrew did a great job of making this. But I think that David Carr is now positioned specifically as the defender of the New York Times and thus as the defender of the faith. And that's an odd position to be in when you're also the media critic, media columnist. And so and caveat here is David came onto this show some time ago in discussion of paywall to attack me so vitriolically that he later emailed to apologize and we have hugged and made up. I have great respect for David, but I think his role may be changing because of the film.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the future of the news and a new documentary on the New York Times and newspapers. It's called Page One. Its director, co-writer, and co-producer is with me in the studio. Andrew Rossi is here. Jeff Jarvis joins us from New York. Alan Mutter joins us in just a moment, as does David Carr, media critic, media columnist for the New York Times. Let's listen to just a little more from Page One, the new documentary rolling out around the country this summer. They remind us of how news organizations, newspapers like the New York Times and others have been in the face of all kinds of powers over time. Includes in the documentary archival tape of President Richard Nixon from June 13th, 1971, speaking with then Deputy National Security Advisor Alexander Haig about the Pentagon Papers from, I guess, White House tapes. Here's the president and Al Haig on what's come out on Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers, and the New York Times.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Al.
Anything new on your front today?
Very significant, this goddamn New York Times expose of the most highly classified documents of the war.
Oh, goddammit, I'm not going to have it. I mean, could the Times be prosecuted?
Look, as far as the Times is concerned, hell, they're our enemies. I think we just ought to do it. And anyway, nobody from the New York Times is to be talked to.
Richard Nixon and Alexander Haig at the very tip-top of the American power structure there with the Times in their face and their conversation on that. Flash forward to just a year or two ago. Here is New York Times young media reporter Brian Stelter in the documentary, Page One, talking with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks as big news and revelations were coming out from WikiLeaks in cooperation with the New York Times. He asks Assange if he, at the head of WikiLeaks, considers himself a journalist.
Hello.
Hi, it's Brian Stelter calling from the Times.
There's a traditional definition of journalism that is objective, totally legal, never breaking the law to obtain content. Do you view yourself as trying to achieve that definition, or is your definition of journalism broader?
A journalism is just a tool. We use a tool to get to the goal.
And tell me what the goal is. Tell me what the goal is.
Well, broadly, our goal is justice.
The goal, says Julian Assange, they're talking with the Times, is justice. Can you get it together, organize around that without big papers like the Times? Here's Wikipedia founder from the documentary Page One, Jimmy Wales, saying bloggers won't do it.
1,000 bloggers all talking to each other doesn't get you a report from a war zone. Somebody's got to take a real risk. There's got to be some infrastructure and some pay, and they've got to go and gather that news originally.
And one more from the documentary. Here's the Times media columnist David Carr.
Not to worry, suggests the new media prophets. The end of the New York Times wouldn't be that big of a deal, they say, because tweets, blogs, and news aggregators could create a new apparatus of accountability.
Say again?
But some stories are beyond the database. Sometimes people have to make the calls, hit the streets, and walk past the conventional wisdom.
And that, Carr suggests, has to be done by news organizations, probably by newspapers. Andrew Rossi, director of Page One, is with me in the studio. Jeff Jarvis of City University of New York School of Journalism with us from New York. Right now from San Francisco, Alan Mutter joins us, consultant on journalism, technology, and new media ventures, adjunct professor at UC Berkeley. Alan Mutter, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So here we are, Alan. This is, you know, right out of kind of the belly of the beast when papers were really in trouble for the first time, any of them seeing, you know, they'd feared this for years, but there were papers falling, big layoffs all over the place. Where have we come, do you think, since that kind of, you know, late 08, 09, sort of heart of darkness, terror time for newspapers? Has it stabilized or not, Alan?
The newspaper business is still a pretty good business today, but it's probably only half as good as it used to be. Newspaper advertising revenues, which carry the burden of paying for the reporters and buying the newsprint and delivering the newspaper, those revenues have dropped by a half in the last 5 years. To ensure the ongoing profitability of the newspapers that still are profitable, and most of them are, there have been huge cutbacks in newsrooms and other resources at newspapers. So probably one out of three newspaper reporters or journalists today are no longer working versus where we were about 5 or 7 years ago.
Jeff Jarvis, what about the debate whether we must have, you know, newspaper-style traditional media organizations and their resources and their structure to get the news done? How's that evolved since what you saw and participated in Page One, Jeff?
Well, one thing that Page One points out is that we're about at the point now in total staffing and journalism as we were pre-Watergate. So it's not as if we've imploded entirely. Of course, those resources are precious and should be used in new ways, and we can always use more journalism and more reporting. But no, we don't necessarily have to do it the way it has always been done. Again, I'm not rejecting those ways. Those ways are part of the picture, but there are now new tools and new ways to collaborate with networks and the public, to use data and databases to get at news, to use witnesses telling what they know to the world in stories. These are new methods that weren't possible in the strictures of print before, and so they are things to celebrate. And there are also new business models. I teach entrepreneurial journalism, and my students are going to, in some cases, create their own work and help to expand and grow journalism.
Andrew Rossi, I mean, you've got the, as old school as it gets here, right at the top of the documentary, giant rolls of newsprint. I know it well from my years in newspaper, sort of, you know, being rolled off and into those presses. How did you come away thinking about what should, maybe needs to be, or must be preserved from that world, and what may not need to be preserved?
I have to say, I actually agree very much with what Jeff just said. And ProPublica is one of the organizations that we feature in Page One, which I think is a really important model for where journalism is headed.
Remind people what that is.
So ProPublica is Paul Steiger's investigative reporting
organization. Paul Steiger, formerly with the Wall Street Journal.
Who was formerly the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. And now ProPublica lives online, but it publishes out its stories to the New York Times, 60 Minutes, various other legacy media organizations. And because it doesn't have to pay for those trucks that you were referring to and the printing presses, its overhead is very low, and it can do that kind of in-depth reporting without huge expense.
But it's not at every city council meeting. It's not even at every session of Congress. It really picks and chooses in the landscape.
So local reporting, you know, in AOL's patch and other, you know, San Diego, other places, has actually been yet another example of how the web can be very effective in a hyper-local environment. And Jeff can speak to that, too, even better than I can. But, you know, the point is, it's not an either-or argument. It's not old media versus new media. It's about a hybrid future, and it's about just keeping society informed, whatever means possible, you know, needs to be used.
You say not either or, but I mean, describe for us, when you were filming this, just how real the fear was, and in many quarters still is, in the newspaper. I mean, fear or terror, practically, that the institutions were just going down.
That's absolutely right, Tom. I believe that there's a new normal now in the newspaper industry. People have accepted the fact that the Rocky Mountain News is gone, that the Seattle Post-Intelligencer is only online. You know, but that being said, there's a lot of optimism in measured and intelligent ways. about the fact that now more than ever, citizens need the original reporting that is coming out of Japan, the Middle East, North Africa. It's really a time when the tools of the insurgency, Twitter and Facebook, are amplifying that original reporting, which is so vital, and they can really work hand in hand to keep us informed and you know, hopefully live in a better world.
Well, sounds great. Andrew Rossi is with us, director of Page One. We'll hear from David Carr in just a moment. Jeff Jarvis is here. Alan Mutter. Guys, with big views on what's going on in the news and newspaper world, a couple of calls here first. James, New Haven, Connecticut. James, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
Well, what do you see, James?
Well, I'm a rising senior at Boston College, and I'm kind of stuck in the old world. I got a summer subscription to the New York Times because I just love reading the physical paper. It's calming, it's relaxing, and every day I read it front to back. But I do see the tension between digital and print media, especially with my friends. A lot of my other students at Boston College, they acknowledge the fact that New York Times, Wall Street Journal, the important papers are that important, but they hate the idea of paying for it when you can get it for free online sometimes. And I know when the New York Times switched to pay for online, a lot of them, you know, they murmured about it, but eventually most of them ended up getting subscriptions when needed because they recognize how important the major papers are.
So, James, you're kind of old school in your love for the paper product. What about your generation? Do you think it's going to end up supporting the kind of news organizations that bring you what the Times, let's say, does?
Well, for me, I actually just wrote a paper on the history of the newspapers, and it was kind of depressing because you see that ad revenues have fallen so much, and it's so hard to keep the papers going. But I don't see the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, I don't see any of them ever failing, because even though a lot of people my generation might get their initial news from a Twitter or Facebook link or whatever, and
James, you're breaking up on me. We're going to bring David Carr in here. Let me get one more call first, if I may. Thank you, James. Phil in Medford, Mass. You're on the air, Phil.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I find it's a very interesting conversation because I was one of the people who worked on the web at CERN back in 92.
So you helped sort of get the whole ball rolling.
Absolutely. So one of the things I was wanting to do there was specifically to disintermediate the press.
Get the Times and other newspapers out from in between people and information?
Actually, it was mostly the Murdoch press, in that in the 92 election, Murdoch's Sun newspaper claimed that it was the Sun what won it. And the problem for me is that he might have been right. And as a patriot and as a Brit, I don't see why an Australian who doesn't even live in Britain should choose our government.
So would you be happier without newspapers in the middle of the news business and their organizations, and maybe by your light's political biases?
I would be happier without the proprietor's bias. And I think that one of the things that is never asked by the establishment media about itself is whether the reason that people are abandoning their product is that the product stinks.
Well, let's ask. Phil, I appreciate your call. David Carr joins us right now from New York, media columnist for The New York Times, featured prominently, wonderfully, in Page One, the new documentary. David Carr, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's nice to be with you, Tom.
There you hear one of our listeners, Anne, architect of the Internet. He's all for disintermediation. And, he parts with a shot there. You know, the news stinks. But he doesn't want the proprietor's bias in the middle here. He's just as happy if it's the web, you know, in all its cacophony bringing us what's going on. What about proprietor's bias, David?
Well, there's a cafeteria of arguments there, and I'm going to sort of shop among them in terms of a newspaper being a projection of an owner's might. There is a long and storied history in American newspapers,
sure,
that I'm sure Jeff and Alan could elucidate on. To the degree that the American public seems to be sort of rearranged into verticals of interest, at least in a cable world and other parts of the news world, blog world, I don't know that bias is what's stinking, is sinking them. I do think the argument about stinking has some traction, because when you look at what was the response when circulation started dropping, newspaper after newspaper cut assets again and again and again. So at a time when they're saying you should pony up, they're not offering a product that I think is really worth paying for. I think one of the sort of baked-in lessons at page one is you see Bill Keller fighting to maintain journalistic, you know, footprint. And that's just not a noble argument. That's a business argument, which is if going forward we're going to be asking people to give us money, we better be able to flex our muscles on a daily basis and do something remarkable.
David Carr, when this documentary was put together, it was kind of, you know, in the heart of the big fear fever in the newspaper industry. It was Fright Week that went on and on here. In the months and even years since some of the earliest footage of this film, do you think things have gotten better? Do newspapers feel steadier to you? Does the Times, or is it still like God knows where this goes?
I can't speak to other newspapers, and the New York Times is the only daily newspaper I've ever worked at. But the fear that you talk about, and I think Andrew captured, that was very real. We started looking at each other and building these little campfires at night, and worrying over things. Right now, I would say our building is a far more stable seeming place, that the, you know, the capital structure, we're paying back, you know, we borrowed a lot of money at very high rates from a Mexican billionaire. Mm-hmm. We're going to pay him back early. That sent a very strong signal into the room that going forward, it's going to be business as usual. But to be sure, a hand-to-hand fight every single day with the lots of little businesses apart from the primary business. The other thing is, the paywall seems to be on plan, seems to be coming along, and I think people take some heart from that as well.
We'll look at that. Jeff Jarvis, how do you see it in the time since this documentary was put together? Does it look like there's a stabilizing trajectory here to you, or that, you know, papers are still in the dropping like flies risk zone?
I think the film, and I think David will agree with this, the film itself has the greatest cause for optimism in the industry, and that is the young man named Brian Stelter. You have Brian who—
The robot sent to destroy David Carr by his joke in the film.
Yeah, it's and a damn smart robot it is.
Right, okay, why?
Because I make him a model to my entrepreneurial students because he created his own work. He created his own blog, became highly respected covering journalism by journalists. He did it anonymously because he didn't want people to know he was only 19 years old in a dorm room when he wrote that blog. The Times outed him, and then the Times wisely hired him. And when he went there, I said, Brian, they have as much to learn from you as you do from them, and it's wonderful to watch David's own relationship with Brian as they mutually learn and teach. So in Brian, I think we see somebody who creates the future of news. As far as the business of news, we see some bright spots. Journal Register, John Payton, who was on your show about the paywalls, is going digital first, print last. He's made his previously bankrupt newspapers profitable. We see some smart things going on. Is there some magic bullet? Absolutely not.
Alan Mutter, we just got 20 seconds before the break. Do you think the Times will be here in 20 years, 50 years?
The Times will be fine because the Times has really mastered, or is beginning to master, the leap into the digital world. It's learned how to make money on the web by selling access to its content. Most other newspapers, or many other newspapers, have not made that leap yet, and their future is less certain than that of the Times.
David Carr, you're an advocate for the paper in the film. Can you be an advocate and a media columnist? What about conflict of interest?
Well, you guys like you are going to have to be the judge of that. I suppose if somebody comes and puts the cuffs on me, I'll know I made a mistake.
David Carr with the New York Times, thanks for spending a minute with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the future of the news. And a new documentary on the New York Times and newspapers. It's called Page One, Inside the New York Times, and that is truly descriptive of what it does. You're sitting in editorial meetings and casual conversations in hallways and offices about what goes where, how to deal with WikiLeaks, how to deal with the changing structure of the news business, and above all, the impact of the digital realm, pushing in very strongly in the last couple of years, in particular on papers including The Times. The director of the film, Andrew Rossi, is with us in the studio here today. Jeff Jarvis, who appears in the film, joins us from New York and the City University of New York School of Journalism. He writes a column on the new media for The Guardian and blogs at Buzz Machine. Alan Mutter is with us, a widely followed blog, Reflections of a Newsasaur, joins us from San Francisco today. There's no guarantee. Here from page one is David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, saying the economic crunch at his alma mater in the newspaper business, The Washington Post, one of them, has decreased the quality of that paper.
I grew up at The Washington Post, and you can't say that the diminishment of that paper in terms of its scale of its staff and its ambitions haven't affected it. You'd be kidding yourself to say it's just trimmed some fat. No, economic circumstances have made it a lesser paper. If that were to happen in any serious way to the New York Times, that would be a terrible tragedy.
A theme of the documentary, page one. Lots of response online here. John in Vermont says, I still get the Sunday paper, but get my daily news from a variety of iPhone, touch, apps. So right now it's a combination. Will that float the boat of news gathering organizations? There's skepticism out there as well. Dane Bug says, where does Judith Miller fit into the news gathering skills of the New York Times? And of course, she had reporting that was deeply flawed with falsehoods about Iraq's alleged nuclear program before the war. We'll ask Andrew Rossi about that. Let's go to our caller, Susan in Tampa, Florida. Susan, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The reason that I've moved away from print media, while I appreciate and am worried that online there's much less way to tell that it's accurate and it's been checked and double-checked, and so I worry about that. But I felt like the New York Times and the other newspapers, while perhaps the reporting was accurate and double-checked, I felt that it was corporate-controlled and that me as a reader, it was getting screened what I was allowed to find out about and what I wasn't. And once I got into the online world where I can get articles from sources that I trust, I'm saying, gosh, you don't see that in the New York Times, or if you do, it's on page A16 in a little paragraph, and I think that's important. And so they were, I feel like the corporate newspapers and corporate news are screening my information.
Susan, I appreciate your call and that observation. I'll take it to Andrew Rossi, director of the film, ask about what he saw inside the Times. But Jeff Jarvis, what about it as a general observation? Susan doesn't want screened news. She's afraid if it comes from a news organization, that's going to mean corporate. That means screening. What do you say, Jeff?
We all need screens of one sort or another. I think we have the advantage now to pick our screens. Clay Shirky at New York University says that we don't have too much information. We have filter failure. And one answer to that was to have an editor of a publication give us The World. But when you think about it, that's patently absurd that we all care about the exact same world. We all have different interests and needs. And now with various online tools, we can get to people who know what's smart. It's not the computers, it's not the algorithms, it's the people. And so I follow people who give me incredible links to all kinds of places, including the New York Times every day, and I value those filters.
Alan Mutter, what about it? Freer news and information, less screened news and information, that must have a kind of value. It certainly does to our caller in Tampa, Florida. Where do you see the balance falling here of gain and loss with that freedom, Alan?
Well, first thing is that having worked in newspapers over the years, I can tell you they're not well organized enough to be controlled by anybody. They are kind of organisms that evolve over time throughout the day.
Tell that to Rupert Murdoch.
Well, Murdoch is Murdoch, yes. But most of the newspapers in this country aren't operated by Murdoch, and most of the newspapers in this country are pretty straight up within the limits of their capabilities. Let me address the other half of the question, which is, yes, people can acquire lots of information online, and it's a beautiful thing. I do it, you do it, we all do it, and we should. However, we also have to recognize that a lot of people will pick and choose sources of information that comport with their interests and their biases. One of the nice things about a really well-edited professional newspaper is the serendipity factor, which allows you to come across things that you wouldn't have known to look up, but that you might not have pursued because it wasn't necessarily your interest, but that teaches you something or informs you about something that you otherwise wouldn't have looked at. So,
how about the Google News page? Isn't that a serendipity factory?
to the degree that people go there, it may be. But, and, you know, there are a lot of places that are aggregating news. We've got Huffington Post, we've got, you know, Google News, we've got all kinds of places in that. But the point is that you don't really know about the bias of the person who's organizing that. Now, Google News happens to be algorithmic, but it has its own inherent bias. It doesn't tend to go toward minority media. It tends to put the last thing first. There is, you know, there is something to be said for human intervention and the edited eye. And when nobody is doing that and you're on your own to acquire information and figure out what's important and what's real, it puts a huge burden on the consumer of the news. If you want that burden, and Jeff does and I do and you do, it's great. If you're an ordinary person, however, who has other things to do in her life, you may find that it's very useful to be using a service that tries to organize things and put things in their proper perspective and context.
Andrew Rossi, how did you come away directing Page One from your time inside the New York Times on this issue of screened news? You were following a lot of the, you know, very TikTok intimate conversation about what to put where. Did it look to you that there was a corporate hand guiding where the sort of Ouija board would go?
No, not at all. You know, I think that great newspaper movies like All the President's Men and others, The Paper, you know, show the role of reporters. But this movie really tries to show, in addition, the role of editors. Bruce Hedlum is a witty and brilliant editor who
in charge of the media desk there.
Who's in charge of the media desk, wrangling his writers, David Carr and Brian Stelter. And Tim Arango is another character we haven't discussed.
Ends up in Iraq as Baghdad bureau chief.
Now is Baghdad bureau chief and is one of those people who actually always believed, like Gay Talese, who's also featured in the film, that being at the Times would be like getting tenure and he could, you know, report on many different things. So,
and then suddenly the whole industry is wobbly.
That's right. And as he notes, you know, that's no longer the model for a journalist. So it's particularly poignant that then he actually is able to be trained to be a foreign correspondent in a war zone. But nonetheless, you know, editors, I think, are playing a vital role at the Times. We see them in the movie in the Page One meetings. That's where we get the name for the film. I think that the curation that is done to determine what should be in the pages of The Gray Lady, and this takes place, you know, at every other important newspaper in the country, that is serving a vital function to people who want to get a quick picture of the world. Now, the website of the Times is also a breathtaking achievement. At any given moment, you can go on there.
But it sits on top of a staff and a tradition that not every news website by any means has. In fact, very few. You bring up this word curation, and I want to come to that because that's become very hot in the digital world itself. I want to loop back to that. But if we may, there's a moment. You mentioned Bruce Hedlum, who's the editor of the media desk at the Times. And in the documentary, Page One, here he's wrestling around thinking about, you know, the Times has cooperated with WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is putting out all kinds of information, videos out of Iraq, huge data dumps ultimately from the U.S. State Department and many other organizations around the world. And in this bit from the documentary, here's the Times editor thinking about this collision of cultures and what WikiLeaks is doing, what the Times is doing, how those two things meet. Let's listen.
We're trying to do a front page story on what this means and what this means for journalism. I mean, clearly it's great for journalists in some ways because then it's out there, but it's this kind of collision of two worlds, like this sort of closed old world of expertise and, you know, classification and information and privacy, and this new world that just kind of wants to crack it all open.
Crack it all open, and then we think about curation. Jeff Jarvis, everybody's talking about curation now on the web, to take that ocean of data and turn it into something meaningful. Is that the same as what the Times has and other newspapers have long done, or does it have a different implication now, Jeff?
I may be partly guilty for the overuse of that word, but I think it's an important idea of what we have here. Another way I put it is that one should do what you do best and link to the rest. The idea that a paper would give the entire world to you was a necessity of the fact that trucks couldn't go very far, but is now absurd. So now I think we need more specialization and we need less waste and less repetition. Many articles are written and rewritten from the Associated Press because you want your own byline on them. We can't afford that kind of inefficiency anymore. I think that we have to raise the bar of quality and raise the expectation of the value that a journalist adds so that they do something that's special, that's unique. Now, in that, then, curation has a very important role because you do what you do best. You report, you write, But when others do good things, when you want to show other perspectives, when you want to show your source material, you do that through links, and that is an act of curation. Not purely aggregation, where you take it all, but curation, where you add value by being selective and pointing to things for a reason.
Let me go to Nick in Greenwich, Connecticut. Nick, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you? I just turned the radio on getting out of work, and I wanted to comment on you mentioned the main articles, people not being interested in reading long articles versus Twitter and the virtual mainstream media. And I just wanted to add a quick comment on that I found very interesting. I'm an avid reader of the Times. I really love to get all of the information I can, but at the same time, I find it a very interesting juxtaposition to be able to, in fact, instantly access news updates as they occur. And I'm finding more and more people are their minds are being shaped and framed into the virtual age, and not being able to comprehend and read and critically analyze these long articles that, I mean, ultimately are more qualitative than the instant updates. But I find there's a balance to be found.
But I kind of drift away from that. Alan Mutter, what about it? An appetite for different forms, shorter forms, you know, bullet points, Twitter bits, tweets, eroding the very interest in what the Times has done. And other papers.
I don't necessarily know that it erodes interest. I think it may well pique your interest. Some people may say, well, it's enough to know that the stock market closed at such and such a level today. Other people may want to know why. So I think tweets and other short forms and digital updates are all part of a well-balanced news diet. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people are living on these little empty info calories rather than not going and getting professional context, and I think that will make us less well-informed as a society.
Terry in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on, Terry.
I think that you and your guest really overestimate the importance of the New York Times or any other major newspaper. The vast majority of the country, you know, doesn't pay attention to the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
That which is published in the New York Times is not near as important to the rest of the world as it is to the media elite and politicians.
You know, Terry, let me ask you then, because I think it's put there in part for what it is and is maybe is not in itself, but also as a kind of symbol of newspapers across the country. If you think of it as representative of the industry, what do you see in your own neighborhood? Are you getting from your newspaper what you need, or have you moved off newspapers, Terry?
I have moved off newspapers. I still subscribe to newspapers because I'm 77 years old and it's a habit I can't shake. It takes me less than 10 minutes to read that in the newspaper that I'm interested in. I already know what the news is because I have been on the Internet.
Right.
Reading the Internet versions of those newspapers that are free.
Terry, I appreciate your call. Jeff Jarvis, 77, and leaving paper newspapers behind in spirit. I mean, he may still subscribe, but he's ahead of the newspaper.
Right, which I love that comment because I think it shows that this is not about age. This is about new possibilities. I have prematurely gray hair myself and learn new tricks and tools. And I think that the important thing to do is to find these new opportunities. I'll go back to Stelter for one moment.
Mm-hmm.
When he covered the Joplin tornadoes, he had no access. He'd forgotten a pen. He had to tweet and SMS things into New York, and his reporting was what was precious. And he begged the desk in New York to just write a story out of his tweets so that he could keep on reporting. And that's the kind of smart new attitude that we need to see what this balance is, this balanced diet, as Alan says. It's true not only in the consumers, who are now also more the consumers, their collaborators. It's also true in the newsrooms.
And what about the notion, Terry puts it bluntly there, New York Times just doesn't matter beyond a certain circle, doesn't matter much to him.
Well, I think that what you've heard from most of your callers today is some celebration of the loosening of control that was there in big mainstream media. And I think that is something to celebrate. The Times matters? Yes, it matters. Do I love the Times? Yes, I do. Do I pay for it to be delivered also to my home every day? Yes. But it's not the only game in town anymore. And in a democracy, in the cacophony that is a democracy, I think we have to enjoy and embrace and enable these many new voices to be heard. That's what it's all about.
Andrew Rossi, you know, as an old newspaper guy, I found it really enjoyable to watch what goes on here. Kind of trip down memory lane for me. Not everybody liked Michael Kinsley reviewed it for the Times from outside. Wasn't crazy about it. But there was a moment in the paper where David Carr's writing a very critical article, a big article, about another newspaper company, the Tribune Company, which had all kinds of problems and kind of bad behavior on its board and beyond. He's going to write that up. They're threatening legal action in return. And he sits back and he ponders how the muscles of the institution, that is, of the New York Times, are going to kick in at some point to support him against those counter threats. You publish this and we'll bury you kind of stuff, I guess. Did you feel that? What about the muscle of a big news organization to give its reporters the courage to go out and challenge the powers that be?
That's really a remarkable scene in the film. David Carr is contacting the Tribune Company and basically confronting them with allegations that not only is their bankruptcy financial, and indeed their allegations of fraud in that, but that their allegations of sexual harassment, and it's really a rugged telephone call. We cut at that point to images of the printing press when David says that the muscles of the institution are going to be put in play, and that's a visual metaphor, you know, not really for the printed product, but for the journalistic promise of quality and accuracy that the Times has, and that ultimately is the muscle. It's the standards that they live up to that give it its power.
We've seen strength and muscle being tweeted out of Tahrir Square in Egypt, an old school type in Page One, that I think the documentary ends up championing, hoping goes on. Andrew Rossi, it's been great to have you with us this hour. Thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Jeff Jarvis, thanks as always. Wonderful to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Alan Mutter in San Francisco. Thank you, Alan.
Pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.